It's Thursday, December 5, 2013. I'm Albert Mobler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The minimum wage was addressed by President Obama yesterday in a speech in which he said that the American economy is in the midst of what he called a relentless, decades-long trend of growing inequality and social immobility. The president has been repeatedly speaking to this issue of late, even as he's having to deal with his health care rollout and with many other issues of both domestic and foreign policy at stake. But the minimum wage is something that he has returned to time and again, sort of. What he has basically returned to is his mantra, and that is that America is now threatened by income inequality and social immobility. There is, without question, a genuine problem behind the president's impulse here. Social immobility is explained by the fact that an increasing percentage of Americans are not moving up in terms of economic advance. As a matter of fact, the great movement into the middle class that characterized America in the 20th century has met all kinds of obstacles in the 21st century, with the generation of young people, young adults especially, alive today, believing and being believed about that they will actually have a lesser income and lesser economic status than their parents and grandparents had. What we also have is an enormous inequality in this country. One of the leading issues of inequality, however, is not often addressed, and that is the massive wealth transfer from younger to older Americans, something that is now very much a part of the nation's economic landscape. In his comments yesterday, the president said, quote, growing inequality and a lack of upward mobility that has jeopardized middle-class America's basic bargain, that if you work hard, you have a chance to get ahead. He said, I believe this is the defining challenge of our time, making sure our economy works for every working American, end quote. From a Christian worldview perspective, what we need to aim for here is the understanding that will lead to the greatest amount of economic justice and the greatest amount of economic opportunity, to indeed the dignification of work and to the recognition of every person's potential as a contributor to the economy. We also need to recognize the fact that we are aiming for human flourishing, and thus we want to support those public policies that ensure the greatest degree of human flourishing. So having said all that, what should be our position on the minimum wage? There is no clear answer to that question. One of the things to watch in the political debate right now is that those who are arguing for the increase in the minimum wage might not believe in it as much as they're saying. And on the other side, those who are opposing the increase in the minimum wage, they may be not opposing it quite so vocally as they appear to be doing. Why? It's because no one is exactly sure how this works. On the one hand, it appears natural that if you want to increase economic opportunity and income for people, you can simply say we're going to raise the minimum wage. And thus, a company would have to pay someone not the $7.25 that is currently the minimum wage, but the $10.10 the president and many in the Senate have proposed. So does that advance their cause? Well, it might. But on the other hand, raising the minimum wage is a form of forced inflation. And that means that even as the minimum wage goes up, the actual value of that dollar goes down. Furthermore, there could be a massive loss of jobs. In other words, you already have what's going on in terms of the Affordable Care Act with the limitation of 30 hours a week, meaning that employers who have employees working 30 hours a week or more have to pay them full-time insurance benefits or face steep fines. That has led many companies to cut workers back in terms of the number of hours they can work and some to eliminate positions altogether. Now we're looking at another question. Every time the minimum wage is raised, there is a loss of jobs. How many jobs will be lost in this particular proposal? No one knows. What would lead to the greatest human flourishing? Well, this is a point in which Christians need to recognize this is an economic argument that is gradient. In other words, there are all kinds of degrees and factors that would enter into this consideration, and no one knows exactly how it might work. It's easy to pose on either side of this kind of question as if we know exactly what is right. And yet, as you look at this kind of question more closely, it's clear that not even economists are of a common mind. As a matter of fact, it's not even clear that they have a common body of facts. Now, this fact is simple, that the current minimum wage is $7.25, and the proposal endorsed by some in the Senate and by President Obama would raise it to $10.10. But would that amount to something just short of a $3 raise? Not if hours are cut back. Would it affect the economy in such a way that it would lead to a massive loss of jobs? Maybe, but then again, the economy has an enormous ability to absorb this kind of factor. But what happens, of course, is that inflation is a forced factor here. If you raise the minimum wage, that will lead inevitably to a raise in prices. If there's a raise in prices, the net effect of raising the wages is minimized. How does that work out? Well, here's a very important factor for our worldview consideration. When it comes to economic issues like this, we often understand their effects only in terms of retrospect. And no one is exactly sure what's going to happen. And at the end of the day, Oftentimes, we can't even adequately explain what factor explains how it did happen. What would lead to the greatest human flourishing here? That's the legitimate question. What will lead to the greatest human dignity and the greatest economic justice? That's our concern as well. The issue here is that there isn't a clear answer to the question. That doesn't mean we don't ask it. It does mean that we answer it with a bit of humility. And also with the understanding that we must be careful, lest what we do to help actually hurts. Shifting to the intersection of morality and economics, time and time again we hear about so-called victimless crimes. The argument is made that we have criminalized too many things in this society. We've criminalized too many acts that should simply be considered a matter of personal liberty. The libertarian argument has been gaining ground in the United States, and yet we need only look to Europe to see just where this appears now to be headed. In Germany, for instance, the government this week is considering a ban on flat-rate prostitution. We won't go into the details here, but the bottom line of it is this. Germany legalized prostitution known as sex work a matter of years ago, and now it is spiraling out of control. As the Associated Press reports, Germany's biggest political parties have agreed to ban so-called flat-rate sex offered by some brothels in the country. The move is a part of a clampdown on Germany's booming prostitution industry that critics, according to the Associated Press, say has gotten out of hand since a little over 10 years ago. Back in 2002, they legalized sex work. They argued back then that it was a matter of personal liberty. They argued that it wasn't something that should be criminalized. People spoke of it then, as some in the United States try to speak of it now, as a victimless crime. And yet, of course, it isn't. It never was. But now what has become very apparent in Germany is that the commercialization, the legal commercialization of the sex trade, has led to the exploitation of those who were involved in the sex industry. Of course, the interesting thing here to note, or at least one interesting thing, is that the German government is interested in economic exploitation, as if that's the greatest evil. It is an evil, but it isn't the only evil involved here. The breakup of families, the marginalization of marriage, the commercialization of what can only be described as fornication. What we're looking at here is a moral scandal that is now spiraling out of control. Now, if they want to address it in Germany as an economic issue, at least they are recognizing this. It is a moral issue. The word exploitation is laden with moral content. And in Germany, one of the interesting things in the political side here is that the parties that agree on almost nothing else, 10 years after the legalization of the sex trade in Germany, are saying this has gotten out of hand and has spun out of control, as if they weren't warned that would happen when they started. Moving across Germany's border to France, yesterday, France's National Assembly voted overwhelmingly to clamp down on the market for prostitution, making it illegal there to pay for sex in any form, at any time, in any context. As the Financial Times of London notes, this makes France now the nation with one of Europe's most conservative policies on the sex trade. An interesting issue then arises. Here you have France moving very clearly, making a moral statement about sex when they're making a moral and legal statement about prostitution. Meanwhile, across the border in Germany, they're trying to say it's an economic matter. We're not so concerned about the morality, the sexual morality involved, but both of them are headed in the same place, if not to the same degree. And that is to recognizing that that libertarian argument about legalizing prostitution has led to moral horrors neither country is willing to accept. One of the interesting aspects of the law that has just been adopted in France is that it criminalizes the client as well as the sex worker, and does so in relatively equal terms. That's a game changer in terms of the sex industry, and if what has happened in France happens elsewhere, it could lead to a new wave of the restriction and the legal clampdown on the sex trade. After years, indeed decades, in which Europe was trying to say this isn't a moral issue. Of course it's a moral issue, and now both Germany and France in the same week have had to deal with it as what? As a moral issue. Here in the United States, the effort to gain legalized same-sex marriage in every state has moved to Utah, where yesterday a federal judge in that state heard a case from three gay couples claiming that their constitutional rights are being violated by Utah's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. This raises a very interesting point. The challenges that are now coming in an organized way against laws and constitutional amendments prohibiting same-sex marriage are originating in some of the country's most conservative states. Why? It's because those who are pushing the legalization of same-sex marriage believe that their progress will only come in those states by the courts, and they're not waiting for that action to come later. They're pushing for it right now. In all of these cases, you have those who are seeking the legalization of same-sex marriage and the overturning of laws and constitutional amendments, claiming the Supreme Court's decision back in June of this year, especially in the Windsor case, arguing that the inevitable logic of the Windsor decision is the legalization of same-sex marriage coast to coast. Of course, that's not what the Supreme Court did. But as Justice Antonin Scalia said in his dissent back in June, that's just waiting for the other shoe to drop. It will be interesting, perhaps even ironic, if the other shoe drops in the state of Utah. On the issue of the great moral changes taking place around us, the great sexual and moral revolution that is now occurring in Western nations, all you have to do is look to Europe to see something at least of the future that America is likely to experience. And when you're looking at the intersection of religion and same-sex marriage, of Christianity, Christian denominations, and the issue of homosexuality, the Church of England continues to be one of the most baffling, if interesting, test cases. Evidence of that came in the last week when the Church of England announced that its clergy would be able to bless, that's the word, to bless same-sex relationships under the proposals that were revealed, as the church adopts a more open but disputed approach to homosexuality, in which the church says same-sex marriages can't be performed, they can't be celebrated, but they can be blessed. The proposals are expected to move forward in the church, but this shows the kind of theological and ethical insanity that is left to the part of those churches and denominations that will not take a clear stand on this issue. This is one of those issues in which the only sane answers are yes or no. The only biblical answer is no. The cultural pressure is all on the side of yes. Just a matter of months ago, the new Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, said that his church had to get over its opposition to the sexual revolution. And yet, he also opposed the legalization of same-sex marriage. So what the Archbishop meant, no one appears to know. And what the church now means to say appears to be inherently conflicting. As a matter of fact, here you have the church saying that the church doesn't recognize same-sex marriages. If it recognized them, it would have to allow them to be celebrated and performed by its clergy. But it doesn't recognize them. Indeed, it opposes them. But now it's going to allow them to be blessed. That's the very word that's being used here within the context of the church and by its clergy. Critics on the right swiftly condemned the blessing proposal as contrary to the church's teaching on sexual conduct. Critics on the left immediately jumped upon the proposal as an inadequate half-step, an embarrassing and discriminatory half-step. The head of the group that came up with the proposal, Joseph Pyling, said the church needs to reflect rapid changes in society as senior clergy express fears of a looming crisis. And by the way, the Church of England has vastly falling attendance rates and is failing to attract its own young people. Pyling said at a news conference, quote, "You can make a church a cold place for gay and lesbian people, or you can make it a more warm and accepting place," end quote. He then went on to say, as if that makes sense, "No member of the clergy or parish would be required to offer such services, and it could not extend to solemnizing same-sex marriages without major changes to the law," end quote. In other words, what does it mean? Who knows? It does mean this. Here you have a church that is hesitating between two opinions. A church that now says, ludicrous as it is, that it will not recognize same-sex unions as marriages, but will allow them to be blessed in church by its clergy. If that doesn't make sense to you, well, you're thinking clearly. But as the writer John Shelton Reed said years ago, from within the Anglican Communion, remember this was a church that was established in order to find a theological rationale for a man's divorce. That is Henry VIII. In other words, this church began offering the kind of rather convoluted moral argument that is now demonstrated. The bigger issue in terms of Anglicans is the fact that many have been claiming what is called comprehensiveness for the Anglican Communion, saying that this is a denomination, a family of churches that can absorb every conceivable theological position under its big tent umbrella. Now, what we have here, of course, is a situation related to sexual morality, which is inherently a theological issue. But this is a church that has allowed atheist priests and has its largest component made up of a so-called evangelical wing. How comprehensive can a church be? What kind of theological sanity can there be in which you have evangelicals on the one hand and atheists on the other, meeting in the same church, or at least in the same church assembly, ordained by the same church, and supposedly operating under the same doctrine and laws? How in the world do you have a church that says, we don't believe same-sex marriages exist, but you are now free to bless them? Meanwhile, just last month, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord George Carey, said that his church is now facing extinction. He said, and has been saying for some time, that it is, quote, only one generation away from extinction, end quote. That's the kind of statement that's routinely made by Christians, pointing to the necessity of evangelism. But in the case of Lord Carey, he's speaking about a church that is losing its membership so fast that some predict it will virtually disappear. Back in the 1990s, as Archbishop of Canterbury, George Carey launched what he called the Decade of Evangelism. But, as the Guardian of London reports, the former archbishop now declares that experiment to have been an unmitigated disaster. The Guardian quotes Professor Linda Woodhead of Lancaster University, who has performed a massive research project of late on how people in different generations in Great Britain see the Church of England. It's really fascinating stuff. For those who are 50 and 16 over, a large number have a positive view of the Church of England, even though they evidently don't go to church. Meanwhile, adults between the ages of 40 and 65 said, and I find this striking, they had no opinion whatsoever on the Church of England. A majority said they didn't have an opinion up or down, positive or negative, about the state church in their own nation. Meanwhile, those who were under 40, there is big trouble for the Church of England. As a matter of fact, 21% of those under age 24 not only didn't have a positive view of the Church of England, but they said that the Church of England is a negative force in society. You're looking at what can only be described as a catastrophe for any church, in this case, the Church of England. Oh, by the way, Lord Carey, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, when he was the Archbishop of Canterbury, he held to his own very convoluted and conflicted position. He held himself to be an enthusiastic supporter of women priests, but at the same time, he allowed those ministers and priests in his church who disagreed with him to be under the leadership of bishops who disagreed with him. In other words, you could choose your bishop, choose your doctrine. Now, that system just fell apart in recent weeks as the Church of England announced it is going forward with the ordination of women bishops, but it just points to the fact that if a denomination or a church wants to be all things to all people, it will end up with the kind of proposal that the Church of England announced last week. We will bless same-sex unions without recognizing them. We won't allow clergy to solemnize same-sex unions, but they can bless them. Again, it makes no sense, but it does explain a denomination or a church that wants to stand in two places at once. Finally, just a few weeks ago, we discussed the fact that one of the fastest-growing businesses in America is the industry trying to figure out where your eyes are going to be. Advertisers and marketers in a digital age are trying to be there before your eyes get there, and they're trying to put their market placement and their advertising where your eyes are going to be. So where are they going to be? Well, yesterday it became very clear that the major advertisers in America think your eyes are going to be on the Super Bowl. When Super Bowl 48 is played, there isn't any available advertising time left, not on the television broadcast. And by the way, every 30-second slot for the upcoming Super Bowl cost $4 million. That's $4 million for 30 seconds of time, which tells you the people who have that kind of money to get their message out think this is how to do it and where your eyes are going to be. Oh, and by the way, the big advance for this Super Bowl is that it's going to be live streamed on the internet as well as available on television. As our Lord said, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Maybe we should also say in the internet age, there will your eyes be also. Those who are advertising on Super Bowl Sunday are counting on it. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.